Chapter 5. At 5 p.m., June 3rd, his ship had sailed from Le Havre de Grasse on the evening of the same day Vaughan embarked at Old Hansport. He had spent most of the afternoon playing court tennis with Delaurier, the famous Negro coach, and felt very dull and drowsy as he watched the low sun's ardency break into green golden eye spots a few sea serpent yards to starboard on the far side slope of the bow wave. Presently, he decided to turn in, walked down to the A-deck, devoured some of the still-life fruit prepared for him in his sitting room, attempted to read in bed the proofs of an essay he was contributing to a festschrift on the occasion of Professor Counterstone's 80th birthday, gave it up, and fell asleep. A tempest went into convulsions around midnight, but despite the lunging and creaking, Tobakov was an embittered old vessel. Vaughan managed to sleep soundly. The only reaction on the part of his dormant mind being the dream image of an aquatic peacock slowly sinking before somersaulting like a diving grebe near the shore of the lake bearing his name in the ancient kingdom of Arrowroot. Upon reviewing that bright dream, he traced its source to his recent visit to Armenia, where he had gone fowling with Armborough and that gentleman's extremely compliant and accomplished niece. He wanted to make a note of it, and was amused to find that all three pencils had not only left his bed table, but had neatly aligned themselves head to tail along the bottom of the outer door of the adjacent room, having covered quite a stretch of blue carpeting in the course of their stopped escape. The steward brought him a continental breakfast, the ship's newspaper, and the list of first-class passengers. Under Tourism in Italy, the little newspaper informed him that a Domodossola farmer had unearthed the bones and trappings of one of Hannibal's elephants, and that two American psychiatrists, names not given, had died an odd death in the Boccoletto range, the older fellow from heart failure and his boyfriend by suicide. After pondering the admiral's morbid interest in Italian mountains, Vaughan clipped the item and picked up the passenger list, pleasingly surmounted by the same crest that adorned Cordula's notepaper, in order to see if there was anybody to be avoided during the next days. The list yielded the Robinson couple, Robert and Rachel, old bores of the family. Bob had retired after directing for many years one of Uncle Dan's offices. His gaze, traveling on, tripped over Dr. Ivan Veen and pulled up at the next name. What constricted his heart? Why did he pass his tongue over his thick lips? Empty formulas befitting the solemn novelists of former days who thought they could explain everything. The level of the water slanted and swayed in his bath, imitating the slow seesaw of the bright blue, white-flecked sea in the porthole of his bedroom. He rang up Miss Lucinda Veen, whose suite was on the main deck amidships exactly above his. But she was absent. Wearing a white polo neck sweater and tinted glasses, he went to look for her. She was not on the games deck from where he looked down at some other redhead in a canvas chair on the sun deck. The girl sat writing a letter at passionate speed, and he thought that if ever he switched from ponderous factitude to light fiction, he would have a jealous husband use binoculars to decipher from where he stood that outpour of illicit affection. She was not on the promenade deck, where blanket-swathed old people were reading the number one bestseller, Saltzman, and awaiting with borborygmic forebubbles the 11 o'clock bouillon. He betook himself to the grill, where he reserved a table for two. He walked over to the bar and warmly greeted bald, fat Toby, who had served on the Queen Guinevere in 1889 and 1890 and 1891, when she was still unmarried, and he a resentful fool. They could have eloped to Lopedusa as Mr. and Mrs. Dyers or Sardi. He espied their half-sister on the forecastle deck, looking perilously pretty in a low-cut, brightly flowered, wind-worried frock, talking to the bronzed but greatly aged Robinsons. She turned toward him, brushing back the flying hair from her face with a mixture of triumph and embarrassment in her expression, and presently they took leave of Rachel and Robert, who beamed after them, waving similarly raised hands to her, to him, to life, to death, to the happy old days when Daman paid all the gambling debts of their son just before he was killed in a head-on car collision. She dispatched the Pozharsky kotleti with gratitude. He was not scolding her for popping up as some sort of transcendental rather than transatlantic stowaway, and in her eagerness to see him, she had botched her breakfast after having gone dinnerless on the eve. She who enjoyed the hollows and hills of the sea when taking part in nautical sports or the ups and oops when flying had been ignominiously sick aboard this, her first liner, but the Robinsons had given her a marvelous medicine. She had slept 10 hours in Vaughn's arms all the time, and now hoped that both he and she were tolerably awake except for the fuzzy edge left by the drug. Quite kindly, he asked where she thought she was going. To Ardis, with him, came the prompt reply. Forever and ever. Robinson's grandfather had died in Araby at the age of 131. Savan had still a whole century before him. She would build for him, in the park, several pavilions to house his successive harems. They would gradually turn, one after the other, into homes for aged ladies, and then into mausoleums. There hung, she said, a steeplechase picture of Pale Fire with Tom Cox up, above dear Cordula's and Tobac's bed, in the suite wangled in 1 minute flat from them, and she wondered how it affected the Tobac's love life during sea voyages. Vaughn interrupted Lucette's nervous patter by asking her if her bath taps bore the same inscriptions as his. Hot domestic, cold salt. Yes, she cried. Old salt, old saltsman, ardent chambermaid, comatose captain. They met again in the afternoon. To most of the Tobakov's first-line passengers, the afternoon of June 4, 1901, in the Atlantic, on the meridian of Iceland and the latitude of Ardis, seemed little conducive to open-air frolics. The fervor of its cobalt sky kept being cut by glacial gusts, and the wash of an old-fashioned swimming pool rhythmically flushed the green tiles. But Lucette was a hardy girl, used to bracing winds no less than to the detestable sun. Spring in Fialta and a torrid May on Minotaur, the famous artificial island, had given a nectarine hue to her limbs, which looked lacquered with it when wet, but re-evolved their natural bloom as the breeze dried her skin. With glowing cheekbones and that glint of copper showing from under her tight rubber cap on nape and forehead, she evoked the helmeted angel of the Yukonsk icon, whose magic effect was said to change anemic blonde maidens into Konski Deti, freckled red-haired lads, children of the sun horse. She returned after a brief swim to the sun terrace where Vaughn lay and said, "You can't imagine."
"I can imagine anything," he insisted.
"You can imagine, okay, what oceans of lotions and streams of creams I am compelled to use, in the privacy of my balconies or in desolate sea caves, before I can exhibit myself to the elements. I always teeter on the tender border between sunburn and suntan, or between lobster and obst, as writes Herb, my beloved painter. I'm reading his diary published by his last duchess. It's in 3 mixed languages and lovely. I'll lend it to you. You see, darling, I'd consider myself a pied cheat if the small parts I conceal in public were not of the same color as those on show."
"You looked to me kind of sandy all over when you were inspected in 1892, said Vaughn.
"I'm a brand new girl now, she whispered. "A happy new girl. Alone with you on an abandoned ship with 10 days at least till my next flow. I sent you a silly note to Kingston just in case you didn't turn up."
They were now reclining on a poolside mat face to face in symmetrical attitudes, he leaning his head on his right hand, she propped on her left elbow. The strap of her green breast cups had slipped down her slender arm, disclosing drops and streaks of water at the base of one nipple. An abyss of a few inches separated the jersey he wore from her bare midriff, the black wool of his trunks from her soaked green pubic mask. The sun glazed her hip bone, A shadowed dip led to the 5-year-old trace of an appendectomy. Her half-veiled gaze dwelt upon him with heavy, opaque greed, and she was right. They were really quite alone. He had possessed Marion Armborough behind her uncle's back in much more complex circumstances, what with the motorboat jumping like a flying fish and his host keeping a shotgun near the steering wheel. Joylessly, he felt the stout snake of desire weightily unwind. Grimly, he regretted not having exhausted the fiend in Villa Venus. He accepted the touch of her blind hand working its way up his thigh, and cursed nature for having planted a gnarled tree bursting with vile sap within a man's crotch. Suddenly, Lucette drew away, exhaling a gentle, "Merde!" Eden was full of people. 2 half-naked children in shrill glee came running toward the pool. A Negro nurse brandished their diminutive bras in angry pursuit. Out of the water, a bald head emerged by spontaneous generation and snorted. The swimming coach appeared from the dressing room. Simultaneously, a tall, splendid creature with trim ankles and repulsively fleshy thighs stalked past the veins, all but treading on Lucette's emerald-studded cigarette case. Except for a golden ribbon and a bleached mane, her long, ripply beige back was bare all the way down to the tops of her slowly and lusciously rolling buttocks, which divulged in alternate motion their nether bulges from under the lamé loincloth. Just before disappearing behind a rounded white corner, the Titianesque Titaness half turned her brown face and greeted Vaughn with a loud, "Hello!" Lucette wanted to know, "Kto sia pava? Who's that stately dame?"
"I thought she addressed you," answered Vaughn. "I did not distinguish her face and do not remember that bottom."
"She gave you a big jungle smile," said Lucette, readjusting her green helmet with touchingly graceful movements of her raised wings and touchingly flashing the russet feathering of her armpits. "Come with me, hmm?" she suggested, rising from the mat.
He shook his head, looking up at her.
"You rise," he said, "like Aurora."
"His first compliment," observed Lucette with a little cock of her head as if speaking to an invisible confidant.
He put on his tinted glasses and watched her stand on the diving board, her ribs framing the hollow of her intake as she prepared 2 ardis into the amber. He wondered, in a mental footnote that might come handy someday, if sunglasses or any other varieties of vision, which certainly twist our concept of space, do not also influence our style of speech. The 2 well-formed lassies, the nurse, the prurient merman, the natatorium master, all looked on with Vaughn.
"Second compliment ready," he said as she returned to his side. "You're a divine diver. I go in with a messy plop."
"But you swim faster," she complained, slipping off her shoulder straps and turning into a prone position. "Mejdu prochim. By the way, is it true that a sailor in Tobakov's day was not taught to swim so he wouldn't die a nervous wreck if the ship went down?"
"A common sailor, perhaps," said Vaughn. "When Mikhman Tobakov himself got shipwrecked off Gavaya, he swam around comfortably for hours, frightening away sharks with snatches of old songs and that sort of thing, until a fishing boat rescued him, one of those miracles that require a minimum of cooperation from all concerned, I imagine."
Dimon, she said, had told her last year at the funeral that he was buying an island in the Gavrils.
"Incorrigible dreamer," drawled Vaughn.
He had wept like a fountain in Nice, but had cried with even more abandon in Valentina at an earlier ceremony, which poor Marina did not attend either. The wedding, in the Greek faith style, if you please, looked like a badly faked episode in an old movie. The priest was gaga and the diakon drunk, and, perhaps fortunately, Ada's thick white veil was as impervious to light as a widow's weeds. Vaughn said he would not listen to that.
"Oh, you must," she rejoined. "Hatia ba patamu. If only because one of her chafers,
Bachelors who take turns holding the wedding crown over the bride's head looked momentarily in impassive profile and impertinent attitude. He kept raising the heavy metallic venets too high, too athletically high, as if trying on purpose to keep it as far as possible from her head, exactly like you, like a pale, ill-shaven twin, delegated by you from wherever you were. At a place nicely called Agony in Tierra del Fuego, he felt an uncanny tingle as he recalled that when he received there the invitation to the wedding, airmailed by the groom's sinister sister, he was haunted for several nights by dream after dream, growing fainter each time, much as her movie he was to pursue from flick house to flick house at a later stage of his life, of his holding that crown over her. "Your father," added Lucette, "paid a man from Belladonna to take pictures. But of course, real fame begins only when one's name appears in that cinema magazine's crossword puzzle. We all know it will never happen, never. Do you hate me now?" "I don't," he said, passing his hand over her sun-hot back and rubbing her coccyx to make her pussy purr. "Alas, I don't. I love you with a brother's love, and maybe still more tenderly. Would you like me to order drinks?"
"I'd like you to go on and on," she muttered, her nose buried in the rubber pillow.
"There's that waiter coming. What shall we have? Honolulu's?
You'll have them with Miss Condor," nasalizing the first syllable, "when I go to dress. For the moment, I want only tea. Mustn't mix drugs and drinks. Have to take the famous Robinson pill sometime tonight. Sometime tonight.
Two teas, please.
And lots of sandwiches, George. Foie gras, ham, anything."
"It's very bad manners," remarked Vaughn, "to invent a name for a poor chap who can't answer, 'Yes, Mademoiselle Condor.' Best Franco-English pun I've ever heard, incidentally."
"But his name is George. He was awfully kind to me yesterday when I threw up in the middle of the tea room."
"For the sweet is all sweet," murmured Vaughn.
"And so were the old Robinsons," she rambled on. "Not much chance is there they might turn up here. They've been sort of padding after me, rather pathetically, ever since we happened to have lunch at the same table on the boat train, and I realized who they were, but was sure they would not recognize the little fat girl seen in 1885 or 6. But they are hypnotically talkative. At first we thought you were French. This salmon is really delicious. What's your hometown? And I'm a weak fool, and one thing led to another. Young people are less misled by the passage of time than the established old, who have not much changed lately, and are not used to the long unseen young changing."
"That's very clever, darling," said Vaughn, "except that time itself is motionless and changeless."
"Yes, it's always I in your lap, and the receding road."
"Roads move?"
"Roads move."
After tea, Lucette remembered an appointment with the hairdresser and left in a hurry. Vaughn peeled off his jersey and stayed on for a while, brooding, fingering the little green-gemmed case with 5 rose petal cigarettes, trying to enjoy the heat of the platinum sun in its aura of film color, but only managing to fan with every shiver and heave of the ship the fire of evil temptation. A moment later, as if having spied on his solitude, the pava, peahen, reappeared, this time with an apology. Polite Vaughn, scrambling up to his feet and browing his spectacles, started to apologize in his turn for misleading her innocently, but his little speech petered out in stupefaction as he looked at her face and saw in it a gross and grotesque caricature of unforgettable features. That mulatto skin, that silver blonde hair, those fat purple lips reenacted in coarse negative, her ivory, her raven, her pale pout.
"I was told," she explained, "that a great friend of mine, Vivian Vale, the couturier, vous avez entendu, had shaved his beard, in which case he'd look rather like you, right?"
Logically, no, ma'am, replied Vaughn. She hesitated for the flirt of a second, licking her lips, not knowing whether he was being rude or ready, and here Lucette returned for her rose petals.
See you a prey, said Miss Condor.
Lucette's gaze escorted to a good riddance exit the indolent motion of those gluteal lobes and folds.
You deceived me, Vaughn. It is
one of your gruesome girls.
I swear, said Vaughn, that she's a perfect stranger. I wouldn't deceive you.
You deceived me many, many times when I was a little girl. If you're doing it now, tu sais que j'en vais mourir.
You promised me a harem, Vaughn gently rebuked her.
Not today. Not today. Today is sacred.
The cheek he intended to kiss was replaced by her quick, mad mouth.
Come and see my cabin,
she pleaded as he pushed her away with the very spring, as it were, of his animal reaction to the fire of her lips and tongue.
I simply must show you all their pillows and piano. There's Cordula's smell in all the drawers. I beseech you.
Run along now, said Vaughn. You've no right to excite me like that. I'll hire Miss Condor to chaperone me if you do not behave yourself. We dine at 7:15. In his bedroom, he found a somewhat belated invitation to the captain's table for dinner. It was addressed to Dr. and Mrs. Ivan Veen. He had been on the ship once before, in between the queens, and remembered Captain Cowley as a bore and an ignoramus. He called the steward and bade him carry the note back with the penciled scrawl, "No such couple." He lay in his bath for 20 minutes. He attempted to focus on something else besides a hysterical virgin's body. He discovered an insidious omission in his galleys where an entire line was wanting, with the vitiated paragraph looking, however, quite plausible to an automatic reader, since the truncated end of one sentence and the lowercase beginning of the other, now adjacent, fitted to form a syntactically correct passage, the insipidity of which he might never have noticed in the present folly of his flesh, had he not recollected, a recollection confirmed by his typescript, that at this point should have come a rather apt, all things considered, quotation. Insiste anime meus, et attente fortiter. Courage my soul, and press on strongly. Sure you'd not prefer the restaurant? He inquired, when Lucette, looking even more naked in her short evening frock than she had in her bikini, joined him at the door of the grill. It's crowded and gay down there, with a masturbating jazz band, no? Tenderly, she shook her jeweled head. They had huge, succulent grou-grou shrimps, the yellow larvae of a palm weevil, and roast bearlet a la Tabakov. Only half a dozen tables were occupied, and except for a nasty engine vibration, which they had not noticed at lunch, everything was subdued, soft, and cozy. He took advantage of her odd demure silence to tell her in detail about the late pencil-palpating Mr. Muldoon, and also about a Kingston case of glossolalia involving a Yukonsk woman who spoke several Slavic-like dialects which existed, maybe, on Terra, but certainly not in Estotiland. Alas, another case, with a quibble on ka, engaged his attention subverbally. She asked questions with pretty co-ed looks of doe-like devotion, but it did not require much scientific training on a professor's part to perceive that her charming embarrassment and the low notes furring her voice were as much contrived as her afternoon effervescence had been. Actually, she thrashed in the throes of an emotional disarray which only the heroic self-control of an American aristocrat could master. Long ago, she had made up her mind that by forcing the man whom she absurdly but irrevocably loved to have intercourse with her, even once, she would somehow, with the help of some prodigious act of nature, transform a brief, tactile event into an eternal spiritual tie. But she also knew that if it did not happen on the first night of their voyage, their relationship would slip back into the exhausting, hopeless, hopelessly familiar pattern of banter and counter-banter, with the erotic edge taken for granted, but kept as raw as ever. He understood her condition, or at least believed in despair that he had understood it, retrospectively. By the time no remedy except Dr. Henry's oil of Atlantic prose could be found in the medicine chest of the past, with its banging door and toppling toothbrush. As he gloomily looked at her thin, bare shoulders, so mobile and tensile that one wondered if she could not cross them in front of her like stylized angel wings, he reflected abjectly that he would have to endure, if conforming to his innermost code of honor, 5 such days of ruddish ache. Not only because she was lovely and special, but because he could never go without girl pleasure for more than 48 hours. He feared precisely that which she wanted to happen, that once he had tasted her wound and its grip, she would keep him insatiably captive for weeks, maybe months, maybe more, but that a harsh separation would inevitably come with a new hope and the old despair never able to strike a balance. But worst of all, while aware and ashamed of lusting after a sick child, he felt, in an obscure twist of ancient emotions, his lust sharpened by the shame. They had sweet, thick, Turkish coffee, and surreptitiously he looked at his wristwatch to check, what? How long the torture of self-denial could still be endured? How soon were certain events coming, such as a ballroom dance competition? Her age?
This is the end of disc number 14. Please insert disc number 15.
They had sweet, thick Turkish coffee, and surreptitiously he looked at his wristwatch to check, what? How long the torture of self-denial could still be endured? How soon were certain events coming, such as a ballroom dance competition? Her age? Lucinda Veen was only 5 hours old if one reversed the human time current. She was such a pathetic darling that, as they proceeded to leave the grill, he could not help, for sensuality is the best breeding broth of fatal error, caressing her glossy young shoulder so as to fit for an instant, the happiest in her life, its ideal convexity, bilboquet-wise, within the hollow of his palm. Then she walked before him as conscious of his gaze, as if she were winning a prize for poise. He could describe her dress only as struthious, if there existed copper-curled ostriches, accentuating as it did the swing of her stance, the length of her legs in ninon stockings. Objectively speaking, her chic was keener than that of her vaginal sister. As they crossed landings where velvet ropes were being hastily stretched by Russian sailors, who glanced with sympathy at the handsome pair speaking their incomparable tongue, or walked this or that deck, Lucette made him think of some acrobatic creature immune to the rough seas. He saw with gentlemanly displeasure that her tilted chin and black wings and free stride attracted not only blue innocent eyes, but the bold stare of lewd fellow passengers. He loudly exclaimed that he would slap the next jackanapes, and involuntarily walked backward with ridiculous, truculent gestures into a folded deck chair, he also running the reel of time backward in a minor way, which caused her to emit a yelp of laughter. Feeling now much happier, enjoying his gallant champagne temper, she steered Vaughn away from the mirage of her admirers back to the lift. They examined without much interest the objects of pleasure in a display window. Lucette sneered at a gold-threaded swimsuit. The presence of a riding crop and a pickaxe puzzled Vaughn. Half a dozen glossy jacketed copies of Saltzman were impressively heaped between a picture of the handsome, thoughtful, now totally forgotten author and a Mingo Bingo vase of Immortel. He clutched at a red rope and they entered the lounge.
"Whom did she look like?" asked Lucette. "En lait et en lard."
"I don't know," he lied.
"Whom?"
"Skip it," she said.
"You're mine tonight. Mine, mine, mine."
She was quoting Kipling, the same phrase that Ada used to address to Dak. He cast around for a straw of Procrustean procrastination.
"Please," said Lucette. "I'm tired of walking around. I'm frail. I'm feverish. I hate storms. Let's all go to bed."
Hey, look, he cried, pointing to a poster. They're showing something called Don Juan's Last Fling. It's pre-release and for adults only. Topical Tabakov.
It's going to be an unmethylated boar, said Lucy.
Hussey School, 1890. But he had already pushed aside the entrance drapery. They came in at the beginning of an introductory picture featuring a cruise to Greenland with heavy seas in gaudy technicolor. It was a rather irrelevant trip since their Tabakov did not contemplate calling at Godhaven. Moreover, the cinema theater was swinging in counter-rhythm to the cobalt and emerald swell on the screen. No wonder the place was impavato, as Lucette observed. And she went on to say that the Robinsons had saved her life by giving her, on the eve, a tubeful of quietus pills.
Want one? One a day keeps no shaw away.
Pun. You can chew it. It's sweet.
Jolly good name.
No, thank you, my sweet. Besides, you have only 5 left.
Don't worry. I have it all planned out. There may be less than 5 days.
More, in fact, but no matter. Our measurements of time are meaningless. The most accurate clock is a joke. You'll read all about it someday. You just wait.
Perhaps not. I mean, perhaps I shan't have the patience. I mean, his charwoman could never finish reading Leonardo's palm. I may fall asleep before I get through your next book.
An art class legend, said Vaughn.
That's the final iceberg. I know by the music. Let's go, Vaughn. Or you want to see Hul as Hulin?
She brushed his cheek with her lips in the dark. She took his hand. She kissed his knuckles, and he suddenly thought, after all, why not?
Tonight?
Tonight. He enjoyed her impatience. The fool permitted himself to be stirred by it. The Cretan whispered, prolonging the free, new apricot fire of anticipation. If you're a good girl, we'll have drinks in my sitting room at midnight. The main picture had now started. The 3 leading parts, cadaverous Don Juan, paunchy Leporello on his donkey, and not too irresistible, obviously 40-year-old Donna Anna, were played by solid stars, whose images passed by in semi-stills, or as some say, translucencies, in a brief introduction. Contrary to expectations, the picture turned out to be quite good. On the way to the remote castle where the difficult lady, widowed by his sword, has finally promised him a long night of love in her chaste and chilly chamber, the aging libertine nurses his potency by spurning the advances of a succession of robust belles. A gitana predicts to the gloomy cavalier that, before reaching the castle, he will have succumbed to the wiles of her sister, Dolores, a dancing girl. Lifted from Osberg's novella, as was to be proved in the ensuing lawsuit. She also predicted something to Vaughn, for even before Dolores came out of the circus tent to water Juan's horse, Vaughn knew who she would be. In the magic rays of the camera, in the controlled delirium of ballerina Grace, 10 years of her life had glanced off, and she was again that slip of a girl qui n'emporte pas, as he had jested once to annoy her governess by a fictitious Frenchman's mistranslation, a remembered triviality that intruded upon the chill of his present emotion with the jarring stupidity of an innocent stranger's asking an aborted voyeur for directions in a labyrinth of mean lanes. Lucette recognized Ada 3 or 4 seconds later, but then clutched his wrist.
Oh, how awful! It was bound to happen. That's she! Let's go, please, let's go. You must not see her debasing herself. She's terribly made up. Every gesture is childish and wrong.
Just another minute, said Vaughn.
Terrible? Wrong? She was absolutely perfect and strange and poignantly familiar. By some stroke of art, by some enchantment of chance, the few brief scenes she was given formed a perfect compendium of her 1884 and 1888 and 1892 looks.
The Gitanella bends her head over the live table of Leporello's servile back to trace on a scrap of parchment a rough map of the way to the castle. Her neck shows white through her long black hair, separated by the motion of her shoulders. It is no longer another man's, Dolores, but a little girl, twisting an aquarelle brush in the paint of Van's blood, and Donna Anna's castle is now a bog flower. The dawn rides past three windmills, whirling black against an ominous sunset, and saves her from the miller who accuses her of stealing a fistful of flour and tears her thin dress. Wheezy but still game, Juan carries her across a brook, her bare toe acrobatically tickling his face, and sets her down top up on the turf of an olive grove. Now they stand facing each other. She fingers voluptuously the jeweled pommel of his sword. She rubs her firm girl belly against his embroidered tights, and all at once, the grimace of a premature spasm writhes across the poor Don's expressive face. He angrily disentangles himself and staggers back to his steed. Van, however, did not understand until much later, when he saw, had to see, and then see, again and again, the entire film, with its melancholy and grotesque ending in Donna Anna's castle, that what seemed an incidental embrace constituted the stone cuckold's revenge. In fact, being upset beyond measure, he decided to go even before the olive grove sequence dissolved. Just then, three old ladies with stony faces showed their disapproval of the picture by rising from beyond Lucette, who was slim enough to remain seated, and brushing past Vaughn, who stood up in three jerky shuffles. Simultaneously, he noticed two people, the long-lost Robinsons, who apparently had been separated from Lucette by those three women, and were now moving over to her. Beaming and melting in smiles of benevolence and self-effacement, they sidled up and plumped down next to Lucette, who turned to them with her last free gift of staunch courtesy that was stronger than failure and death. They were craning already across her, with radiant wrinkles and twittery fingers toward Vaughn, when he pounced upon their intrusion to murmur a humorous bad sailor excuse and leave the cinema hall to its dark lurching. In a series of 60-year-old actions, which now I can grind into extinction only by working on a succession of words until the rhythm is right, I, Vaughn, retired to my bathroom, shut the door. It swung open at once, but then closed of its own accord, and using a temporary expedient less far-fetched than that hit upon by Father Sergius, who chops off the wrong member in Count Tolstoy's famous anecdote, vigorously got rid of the prurient pressure, as he had done the last time 17 years ago. And how sad, how significant, that the picture projected upon the screen of his paroxysm, while the unlockable door swung open again with the movement of a deaf man cupping his ear, was not the recent and pertinent image of Lucette, but the indelible vision of a bent bare neck and a divided flow of black hair and a purple-tipped paintbrush. Then, for the sake of safety, he repeated the disgusting but necessary act. He saw the situation dispassionately now, and felt he was doing right by going to bed and switching off the ectric light, a surrogate creeping back into international use. The blue ghost of the room gradually established itself as his eyes got used to the darkness. He prided himself on his willpower. He welcomed the dull pain in his drained root. He welcomed the thought, which suddenly seemed so absolutely true and new, and as vividly real as the slowly widening gap of the sitting room's doorway, namely, that on the morrow, which was at least and at best 70 years away, he would explain to Lucette, as a philosopher and another girl's brother, that he knew how agonizing and how absurd it was to put all one's spiritual fortune on one physical fancy, and that his plight closely resembled hers, but that he managed, after all, to live, to work, and not pine away, because he refused to wreck her life with a brief affair, and because Ada was still a child. At that point, the surface of logic began to be affected by a ripple of sleep, but he sprang back into full consciousness at the sound of the telephone. The thing seemed to squat for each renewed burst of ringing, and at first he decided to let it ring itself out. Then his nerves surrendered to the insisting call, and he snatched up the receiver. No doubt he was morally right in using the first pretext at hand to keep her away from his bed, but he also knew, as a gentleman and an artist, that the lump of words he brought up was trite and cruel, and it was only because she could not accept him as being either that she believed him.
«Mjozhno priti tepir? Can I come now?» asked Lucette.
«Yanya adin. I'm not alone», answered Van.
A small pause followed, then she hung up. After he had stolen away, she had remained trapped between the cozy Robinsons. Rachel, dangling a big handbag, had squeezed by immediately to the place Van had vacated, and Bob had moved one seat up. Because of a sort of pudeur, she did not inform them that the actress, obscurely and fleetingly billed as Teresa Zagris in the going-up lift list at the end of the picture, who had managed to obtain the small but not unimportant part of the fatal gypsy, was none other than the pallid schoolgirl they might have seen in Lador. They invited Lucette to a coke with them, proselytical teetotalists in their cabin, which was small and stuffy and badly insulated. One could hear every word and whine of two children being put to bed by a silent, seasick nurse so late, so late. No, not children, but probably very young, very much disappointed honeymooners. "We understand," said Robert Robinson, going for another supply to his portable fridge. "We understand perfectly that Dr. Veen is deeply immersed in his interesting work. Personally, I sometimes regret having retired. But do you think, Lucy, Prosit, that he might accept to have dinner tomorrow with you and us and maybe another couple, whom he'll certainly enjoy meeting? Shall Mrs. Robinson send him a formal invitation? Would you sign it too?"
"I don't know. I'm very tired," she said, "and the rock and roll are getting worse. I guess I'll go up to my hutch and take your quietus. Yes, by all means, let's have dinner, all of us. I really needed that lovely cold drink."
Having cradled the nacred receiver, she changed into black slacks and a lemon shirt, planned for tomorrow morning, looked in vain for a bit of plain notepaper without caravelle or crest, ripped out the flyleaf of Herb's journal, and tried to think up something amusing, harmless, and scintillating to say, in a suicide note. But she had planned everything except that note, so she tore her blank life in two and disposed of the pieces in the WC. She poured herself a glass of dead water from a moored decanter, gulped down one by one four green pills, and sucking the fifth, walked to the lift, which took her one click up from her three-room suite, straight to the red-carpeted promenade deck bar. There, two slug-like young men were in the act of sliding off their red toadstools, and the older one said to the other as they turned to leave,
"You may fool his lordship, my dear, but not me, oh no."
She drank a Cossack pony of Kloss vodka, hateful, vulgar, but potent stuff, had another, and was hardly able to down a third because her head had started to swim like hell from sharks, Tubakovich. She had no purse with her. She almost fell from her convex, ridiculous seat as she fumbled in her shirt pocket for a stray banknote.
"Betty Dee,"
said Toby the barman with a fatherly smile, which she mistook for a leer.
"Bedtime, miss,"
he repeated and patted her ungloved hand. Lucette recoiled and forced herself to retort distinctly and haughtily.
"Mr. Veen, my cousin, will pay you tomorrow and bash your false teeth in."
"Six, seven, no, more than that, about 10 steps up.
Dimanche,
legs and arms.
Dimanche, déjeuner sur l'herbe, tout le monde pue.
Ma belle-mère avait son râtelier, sa petite chienne. After too much exercise, gulps twice and quietly vomits a pink pudding onto the picnic nappy. Après quoi, she waddles off. These steps are something. While dragging herself up, she had to cling on to the rail. Her twisted progress was that of a cripple. Once on the open deck, she felt the solid impact of the black night and the mobility of the accidental home she was about to leave. Although Lucette had never dived before, Violet, from such a height, in such a disorder of shadows and snaking reflections, she went with hardly a splash through the wave that humped to welcome her. That perfect end was spoiled by her instinctively surfacing in an immediate sweep instead of surrendering underwater to her drugged lassitude as she had planned to do on her last night ashore, if it ever did come to this. The silly girl had not rehearsed the technique of suicide as, say, free-fall parachutists do every day in the element of another chapter. Owing to the tumultuous swell and her not being sure which way to peer through the spray and the darkness and her own tentacling hair, T-A-C-L, she could not make out the lights of the liner and easily imagined many-eyed bulk mightily receding in heartless triumph. Now I've lost my next note. Got it. The sky was also heartless and dark, and her body, her head, and particularly those damned thirsty trousers felt clogged with Oceanus Nox, N-O-X. At every slap and splash of cold wild salt, she heaved with anise-flavored nausea, and there was an increasing number, okay, or numbness in her neck and arms. As she began losing track of herself, she thought it proper to inform a series of receding Lucettes, telling them to pass it on and on in a trick-crystal regression, that what death amounted to was only a more complete assortment of the infinite fractions of solitude. She did not see her whole life flash before her, as we all were afraid she might have done. The red rubber of a favorite doll remained safely decomposed among the myosotes of an unanalyzable brook. But she did see a few odds and ends as she swam like a dilettante Tobakov in a circle of brief panic and merciful torpor. She saw a pair of new, vair-furred bedroom slippers, which Brigitte had forgotten to pack. She saw Van wiping his mouth before answering, and then, still withholding the answer, throwing his napkin on the table as they both got up. And she saw a girl with long black hair quickly bend in passing to clap her hands over a dacle in a half-worn wreath. A brilliantly illumined motorboat was launched from the not-too-distant ship, with Van and the swimming coach and the oilskin-hooded Toby among the would-be saviors. But by that time, a lot of sea had rolled by, and Lucette was too tired to wait. Then the night was filled with the rattle of an old but still strong helicopter. Its diligent beam could spot only the dark head of Van, who, having been propelled out of the boat when it shied from its own sudden shadow, kept bobbing and bawling the drowned girl's name in the black, foam-veined, complicated